North Korea is not the subject for destruction, but it should be the subject for change.
South Korea's president pushes for a denuclearized peninsula. It's Thursday, November 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, North Korea tops Trump trip agenda. Bangladeshi ambassador discusses Rohingyas with VOA. New Chinese maritime technology. Singing with new lungs and urban solar power. It's all on today's VOA Asia. In his State of the Nation address, South Korean President Moon Jae-in told the National Assembly in Seoul his government will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea, and the South will not possess nuclear weapons. Pointing to a 1992 joint denuclearization declaration signed by both Koreas, he said his government is making efforts to manage the situation and bring about peace on the peninsula. Mr. Moon's comments came a day after a prominent North Korea defector, Taeyong Ho, said in Washington he thinks he knows how best to deal with the growing North Korean nuclear and missile threat.
North Korea is not the subject for destruction, but it should be the subject for change. Everyone agrees with permanent peace on Korean Peninsula. So since our goal is peace, then the means to achieve that goal should be peacefully. That is the second point which I want to deliver. And thirdly, I support maximum pressure policy. But I strongly believe that maximum pressure should go together with maximum engagement. And maximum engagement, I think, should include not only the Kim Jong-un leadership, but also North Korean population as well.
Tae was the one-time deputy chief of mission at the North Korean embassy in London before he defected last year. He told the Centers for Strategic and International Studies he understands why North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants a nuclear arsenal. He said Kim felt he lacked legitimacy when he was selected by his late father in 2012, viewed economic reform as a long-term project, saw the military's conventional capability as obsolete, and feared North Korea could become a victim of a humanitarian intervention, as happened in Libya in 2011. Cedric Layton, a crisis management consultant and former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Tae's views remind him of what the West's approach was to the former Soviet bloc.
There are times when a policy of engagement coupled with a policy of military strength can be very useful in getting a regime, especially a regime like the North Korean, to modify some of its behaviors. I think it would be very important to get the people on the side of the West. And the kinds of things that Mr. Tae refers to are, I think, quite workable policy options. And if you couple those with periodic shows of force, such as joint exercises and some other actions that are out there, if you couple that with a soft power response that in essence shows the difference, draws the contrasts, not explicitly but implicitly, between life in North Korea and life in the rest of the world, that makes a big statement to the potential recipients of such a message.
What insights does Tae give us about Kim and the way that perhaps we can deal with him?
I think the key thing here is the degree to which Kim Jong-un has incredible insecurities. The way in which Mr. Tae describes his need to show his strength to gain respect, it is basically about that gaining that respect because he was so young when he assumed power. And that makes a very, very big difference not only in Korean culture, but also in his perception of self. If it becomes really important, I think, in the case of the United States and also in the case of South Korea, to look at that need for respect, that need for acceptance, as being the key to working with somebody like that. The North Korean regime clearly views nuclear weapons and their acquisition of nuclear weapons as a guarantee that they will stay in power. We have to disabuse them of that notion then. And the way we do that might be pretty hard to actually execute, but nonetheless, it would be something that we should try to do because it becomes important to let them know that no matter what they do, they are still at risk of losing control of their country, and that no matter what weapons they use, no matter how they attempt to isolate their people, there will always be ways around that isolation, and that will be the key to engaging them over the long term.
In the meantime, Tay said while he called the regime's reign of terror can't be changed, reform can come from within through the dissemination of outside information. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Reports say United States engaging in secret diplomatic overtures with North Korea. Myanmar slams Bangladesh for delaying Rohingya return. Shinzo Abe re-elected as Japanese Prime Minister. Analysts say South Korea-China detente good for Northeast Asia stability. With masks and flair, Indian dance aims to spur audiences to climate action. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to visit our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A majority of Americans now view North Korea as the most immediate threat to the United States. President Donald Trump will make the North's rival, South Korea, his second stop a week from now on his Asia trip. How to deal with Pyongyang's ongoing development of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles is to be the dominant item on his agenda with leaders throughout the visit. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has the latest on Mr. Trump's trip.
Leading up to the president's visit, members of his cabinet have been in Asia, helping to set the stage for the top-level discussions about what steps to take regarding North Korea.
Our goal is not war, but rather the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
There is increasing anxiety on both sides of the Pacific about what could be necessary to achieve that.
I think we will come down to a point where I liken to the kind of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there is a finite time period where we have to make a decision, whether it's political or military, that really will change the political landscape of the Korean Peninsula.
So far, the U.S. president and the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, have had an unprecedented, highly charged exchange of rhetoric.
The insults traded back and forth decrease the legitimacy of the United States and of the United States president. It bothers me to see an American president sink to the same level of insults and threats that we have seen from the North Koreans over many years.
Some in South Korea, including the main opposition Conservative Party, are pushing not only to have American tactical nuclear weapons brought back to the country, but also for U.S. support to allow Seoul to possess its own nukes.
You sense the anxiety, you sense the fear, you sense that this is something different that the Koreans are facing. And so as a result, I think they have latched onto this idea that tactical nuclear weapons may provide that kind of security to them. And they haven't thought through all of the messy issues that come with it.
The president is to fly to Beijing from South Korea. There, he will discuss the heightened tension on the Korean Peninsula with President Xi Jinping. China is North Korea's only remaining significant ally. It has expressed frustration with its smaller but increasingly provocative neighbor. Trump is to request China apply even more pressure on Kim Jong-un. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Happening now in Asia, Japan's Shinzo Abe is re-elected prime minister. The 63-year-old Abe took office in December 2012, promising to reboot the stale economy and bolster defense. His Liberal Democratic Party-led coalition retained its two-thirds supermajority in Parliament's lower house in the October 22nd election. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. As hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees stream from their homes in Myanmar into neighboring Bangladesh, authorities there are being very careful about just who these refugees are. VOA State Department correspondent Nike Ching sat down with the Bangladesh ambassador to the United States for an exclusive interview on the situation. VOA Asia's Ira Melman has more.
Ambassador Mohammed Ziauddin outlined the mass migration into his country by the Rohingya people as an event that cannot be overstated.
It is possibly one of the darkest chapters in human history. In this strategic pre-planned program has led to the death of thousands of people, men, women, and children, thousands of women raped and dishonored, and hundreds of thousands of people fleeing bullets, baton, and bludgeons to crossing over to next-door neighbor Bangladesh.
Over a half million Rohingyas have poured into Bangladesh from Myanmar's Rakhine State since August 25th, when members of the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, launched a coordinated attack on border posts and military camps of the Myanmar Army, killing 12 officers and setting off a state-sponsored crackdown. Members of ARSA, depending on whom you talk, are defined as either freedom fighters, militants, or terrorists. Nike Ching asked Ambassador Ziauddin what Bangladesh calls them.
Of course they are terrorists. Anybody who is going to go and attack and disrupt the law and order situation in the country, they are terrorists. If their attacks tend to the death of people, they are terrorists, of course.
Although the Rohingyas thought to have taken action against the Myanmar army are thought to be a small minority of their people, Ambassador Ziauddin says Bangladesh cannot allow them to stay in their country.
If some of these militants come to Bangladesh, then we have our own problems of terrorism and extremism. And it could be that these elements may join forces with those who are there in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, we have got actually 8 outlawed outfits, we call them. They are extremist organizations who have been off and on carrying out terrorist activities. But these elements, if they join up with the existing terrorist organizations in Bangladesh, they may become emboldened, and they may bolstered, and this kind of activities may again erupt, appear. So we want this Rohingya problem to be resolved as soon as possible. The sooner, the better.
To make it sooner rather than later, the ambassador told VOA that as the refugees enter camps set up for them, they're being identified.
There has been 85 registration booths have been established. And they are registering 13,000 Myanmarese nationals every day. So the total number is actually registered is over 300,000.
Nike Ching then asked Ziauddin whether Bangladesh wanted the Rohingyas to stay in their country.
Rohingyas or the Myanmarese nationals, it is always preferable that they should go back to their own hearth and home from where they came. This is where they build their roots. So you'd like to go back to their roots. And for that, we need to have a proper climate over there, an environment. And I'm sure, with Myanmar, we have really good relationship. I mean, this also we believe that on the basis of the kind of relationship which we have historically, we'll be able to resolve this. And I believe that the Myanmarese government will see sense in taking them back.
Something he said that has been agreed upon by the Myanmar leader.
Our home minister has visited Bangladesh recently and had the opportunity of meeting Madam Aung San Suu Kyi. And during the meeting, it came to pass that Madam Aung San Suu Kyi has given word that these people are going to be taken back to Myanmar.
Considering what many of those refugees have experienced in their homeland, a return might not be all that welcome. Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Olympic Flame's long cross-country journey through South Korea got underway Wednesday, marking the official countdown to the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. After arriving from Athens, Greece, the birthplace of the Olympic Games, the flame lit a ceremonial cauldron and torch. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a wind turbine installation vessel developed in China for use near its coasts is sparking new hope that the dominant party in a six-way maritime sovereignty dispute will share technology. But when analysts warn Beijing seldom brings in outsiders. The Chinese government has a wide technological lead in the South China Sea sovereignty dispute with Taiwan and four Southeast Asian countries. Its arsenal includes a bathyscaphe, a discovery of an ice-like fuel under the seabed, and plans to install an ocean observation network. Beijing also dominates five other governments in military control of the disputed South China Sea. Because of sensitivities about the scope of its claim to most of the 3.5 million square kilometer sea, experts like Colin Koh, a maritime security research fellow at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, say China seldom shares much despite periodic statements about involving other countries.
At the same time, you use that for military defense in the South China Sea, then you can tell other people that I'm contributing data for the greater good of mankind. It's something like tacit acquiescence or acknowledgement of China's dominance and recognizing that you are using its goods and thereby you are recognizing that it has control.
The wind-harnessing vessel is just the most recent example of China hinting at cooperation, which would help it be seen as a good neighbor. In May, China's official Xinhua news agency quoted a government source calling the discovery of combustible ice, an energy source that turned up under the South China Sea after two decades of research, a way to help resolve the energy resource problem and boost economic development and exchanges between countries. But aside from helping to supply foreign-registered cargo ships, Yun Sun, East Asia Program Senior Associate at the Stimson Center think tank in Washington, says China hasn't shared much more.
I haven't seen precedent so far, but I think that's how the Chinese portray their build-ups in the South China Sea, that these civilian facilities, civilian equipment could someday be treated as an international public good. I think that's how they portrayed it to justify it. I just haven't seen specific examples of where the Chinese welcome other countries to use what they have.
China has the tools to detect the activity of other countries around the sea with advanced technology, such as radar, aerial drones, and a satellite covering parts of the sea's Paracel and Spratly Island chains. Other countries lack the budget or expertise to vie with China's maritime technology. Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam all claim parts of the South China Sea that overlap a tract China calls its own. China's claim covers about 90% of the sea between its south coast and the island of Borneo. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. This news alert from VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping met Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev in Beijing, stressing China's firm commitment to developing and deepening relations with Russia. Xi said he believed the comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination would generate new opportunities and achieve new results. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the extent to which organ transplants can allow recipients not only to survive but thrive was on display this week at a medical conference here in the United States. A former opera singer who received a double lung transplant 5 years ago returned to the stage to sing with her donor's daughter. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
For opera singer and lung transplant recipient Charity Tillman Dick, singing once again seemed impossible.
When I woke up, I couldn't breathe. I was still on a respirator. And it was after this 34-day coma, so all of my muscles had atrophied. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. I couldn't eat. I couldn't do anything. I could hardly move more than batting my eyes. And I could move my neck a little bit.
But since receiving her new lungs in 2012, she has worked to be back here.
And there was this tiny wisp of a voice. And so I started singing every day, and I doubled the amount of time because first, to get through a short song was exhausting. But it's amazing what we can accomplish when we work hard and when we're determined.
She was joined on stage by the daughter of the woman whose lungs she received.
I was able to meet my donor about 10 months after the transplant, my donor's daughter, about 10 months after the transplant. And we've become wonderful friends. And so today we're going to sing together.
American, it was something neither woman could have imagined.
Her being in my life and her having my mom's lungs has impacted me in a deep way, because it's almost like I would have always wanted to have sang with my mom, but I didn't have that relationship with her, to where I would see her all the time. And getting to do that through charity it's amazing. It's cities and country.
For both women, it has reaffirmed something fundamental about their American experience.
We are all part of this big human family, and I think transplant shows us that better than anything. And we need to reach out. I have the lungs of an immigrant. You know, I breathe because of someone who came to this country to find a better life.
The two debuted their song, American Rainbow, at the annual Medical Innovation Summit before hundreds of doctors and medical executives. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
If you happen to live in a city, well, tapping into solar power can be quite a challenge. Chances are you live in an apartment and can't install solar panels or get access to your roof. But VOA's Tina Trin says a community-shared solar program is now allowing everyone to benefit from solar energy.
This is what a typical solar farm looks like. Row after row of solar panels gleaming in the sun. But in New York City, where space comes at a premium, this is what a solar farm looks like.
It's important to recognize what your assets are. So being able to look at rooftop spaces, which are often underutilized, they have a huge potential for us to be able to proactively engage and allow them to be productive spaces.
City officials are creating a community shared program on top of public housing sites that will provide solar energy to low and middle income residents.
Community solar means you don't have to worry about installing anything on your rooftop. You can buy a portion of a neighborhood shared solar farm and switch to solar that way.
Steph Spears is the co-founder of Boston-based startup Solstice, which partners with local solar farms in Massachusetts and New York State to provide community access to solar power.
The electricity from the shared farm goes back to the grid, and you as a participant see the credits show up on your utility bill every month.
Whether it comes from a farm or a city rooftop, community shared solar allows everyone to benefit and sometimes even find a new career. Miguel Rodriguez grew up in New York's public housing and now works with community service program Green City Force to educate and train low-income young adults in sustainable jobs.
Just the fact that we can bring this information to people, bring it to light, that opens the doors to many different possibilities. People will see firsthand how this will impact their community.
It's a new industry, and you know, young people who are just getting into it today are getting in on the ground floor.
It seems community shared programs may provide more than just solar power. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We remind you that you can also find our programs on iTunes and SoundCloud for you to download and take our podcast wherever you happen to go. You can always find us at voanews.com, where we stream daily, and also on VOA Asia Facebook. We invite you to contact us on Facebook and up by email if you like, voaasia@voanews.com. We'd like to thank everybody at Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 in Chiang Mai University, Thailand, who are listening to our program today. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks, too, go out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Keith Holmes, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day.